Hi, this is Steve Chandler, and I want to talk today about the joy of selling. There are basic habits that I found in the last 10 years or so of my work with people who work in sales as individuals and teams of salespeople, basic habits that take them to the top of their list of salespeople. And I want to look at what these habits are. Why is it that some people sell all they want to sell, feel a certain joy in their work, and exceed almost at will, whereas the other 80% seem to struggle and have a hard time, think of sales as stressful, and never really feel any joy? I think when we identify these habits and understand them completely, the answer will start to come to light. These habits are things that anyone can learn, and it's been my history and my experience that I've been able to teach anybody these habits. It doesn't take an extraordinary person to lead the team, or a genetic freak, or a high IQ that's off the charts, or some kind of movie star that bonds with people by their very looks. All it takes is an understanding of what works in sales, and we're going to get going on it. Of the 10 basic habits that seem to lead people up, to lead their team in sales, number one is creative listening. The habit of really bringing full mental focus and consciousness to every conversation with a client. And when I say client today, I'm talking about prospective client, existing client, former client. We're talking about people who have bought from us or are going to buy from us. Creative listening is different than distracted listening, agitated listening, multitasking listening, and all the kinds of listening that make a relationship worse after the conversation, not better. Creative listening means bringing full mental focus, taking a tremendous amount of notes, and really drawing out of that person the essence of what they want to have happen in their lives and what they want to have happen with our company. That's true creativity. Creative listening sounds almost like an oxymoron. It sounds like listening should be just something passive, something we sit and do without really doing anything. But that's the trap. That's what causes people to be bad listeners. They sit there as if there's nothing to do when someone's talking, and their mind wanders. They don't really appreciate what that person is thinking about, and they don't accomplish much. They don't produce much, and they don't create much during the listening. People who are gifted at sales, and they've made themselves gifted, that's an important point. People who are gifted at sales listen creatively. They listen with a searching, searchlight kind of consciousness that goes inside the mind of the client and pulls certain things out and illuminates certain opportunities and potentials in what the client is talking about. Creative listening. Creative listening improves when salespeople are conscious of how they're listening. How did I listen to that person? I just had a 5-minute phone conversation. How was I? On a scale of 1 to 10, how well did I listen? How much consciousness did I bring to the conversation? Habit number 2, managing actions rather than time. Now, this is really an interesting habit that successful salespeople evolve to. They don't try to manage their time. They don't think in terms of being overwhelmed or multitasking or I don't have enough time for this. I wish I had enough time. There's never enough time in the day. They don't think in terms of time. In fact, what they finally realize and what they come to terms with and achieve a certain level of peace about is the fact that everybody has the same amount of time. Time cannot be managed. Time cannot be expanded. It can't be contracted. Nothing can be done with time. So the successful salesperson moves to a different category. The successful salesperson, instead of managing time, manages actions. What actions do I want to take today that are going to move me toward my goal? What are the actions I want to take? Well, here's where it really gets interesting. A successful salesperson will actually have a to-do list that he or she breaks down into actionable actions. In other words, if on your to-do list for one day that you're at work, you might have family picnic, that some of your downtime is going to be used arranging the family picnic. Now, family picnic on your to-do list is not an action. It's a large category of accumulated tasks that must be done, and because it's not a specific action, it's intimidating. When you look at your to-do list and it says family picnic, you're thinking of 100 things that have to be done for that picnic, and your mind shuts down and says, I can't do that right now. Let's say you have a difficult client, and you've been having a hard time with that client, and we'll call that client IBM. And that client's been a difficult client, and you need to do a bunch of things, and you have on your to-do list for today IBM. Now, once again, that's not an action. Once again, IBM is simply an intimidating general category. 9 out of 10 people have to-do lists that are generalized, intimidating, and not actionable. When you break your to-do list down to doable actions, your day starts to move faster, you get more done, your self-esteem goes up, and you feel happier. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have the family picnic to plan. And when you're looking at your to-do list for that day, the first thing you're asking yourself, okay, I've got to plan the family picnic. What's the first step I have to take? What's the first action I have to do? And you realize you want to call the park, and you want to reserve the pagoda or the ramada or the area in the park that you need to reserve. So you look up the park number and you write that down, and that's now on your list for today. That's an action. Now here's what happens when you have a list of actions instead of general categories. You might be waiting for a client in their waiting room, and an administrative assistant comes out and says to you, Mr. X is going to be maybe 20 minutes late for this meeting. Do you mind waiting? Can I bring you some water? There's a phone over there if you need to use it. And you say, no, I don't mind. I'll wait. You're in the waiting room. You open your organizer, your notebook, your planner, and you look at your to-do list. Now, if you have generalized things on that list, you're paralyzed. If it says IBM, if it says the family picnic, what can you do? You're in a waiting room. You can't do anything about that. But let's say your to-do list has actions on it, specific actions. So you open your notebook and you see, here is the phone number for the city park that we're going to have our picnic in. You're sitting there by a phone. You have a glass of water. Very relaxed, very comfortable. You make a phone call. Hi. My name is Steve Chandler. I'd like to reserve the park for this day. I'd like to reserve that ramada. And now that's done, and you cross it off. IBM, you've taken that the night before and broken it down. There's one person you need to call to set up an appointment to go see to fix that account. You've got the person's name and phone number written down. So you look at your watch, and you have time to call him. You call, you set up an appointment. Now you look at your other actions. There may be 3 or 4 more you can do while you're in the waiting room and cross them off. Then you go into your meeting. When you make a commitment to manage your actions and you break all your general categories down to actionable actions, your days are much more efficient and effective, and you have a great deal more fun. You begin to learn the joy of selling. Habit number 3, ongoing development of pride in the profession. it's really important when I work with salespeople that they continue to reshape their opinion of their own profession, that they don't allow public and societal biases against sales to creep into their own self-esteem and into their own self-image. It's very important that people really see sales for what it is. It's the most fundamental component of the free enterprise system. It's the most important part of any business, and really, in the long run, any free society. The exchange of value for value is how everything works. It's really how civilization works. And without salespeople initiating this exchange, we would all go back to the old days of people hoarding their animals and other people hoarding their crops and everyone being suspicious of each other. And this exchange, this free exchange that goes on through sales, is really the heart and soul of our whole society. No matter what the movies say about it, or the radio says about it, or the sitcoms say about it, or the plays like Death of a Salesman, it's really important that salespeople continue to see their profession with a tremendous amount of pride. High self-esteem people sell more over and over again. Habit number 4, living purposefully all day long. When a salesperson has created a to-do list, a basic plan for the day, it doesn't have to be down to the minute. It can be general. It can just be 6 things I really want to get done today. That would be max. 6 important things, but that's the key word, important. If they're truly important things, if these are the things that have high return, move me toward my goal faster than other things, then I'm living purposefully. I'm not multitasking. Multitasking is the greatest myth in modern day business. People, the brain does not multitask. People do not multitask. It's not set up that way. They think they are. They're doing one thing badly, quickly, moving to another thing, doing it badly, quickly, doing another thing badly, quickly, and leaving 100 things incomplete that they'll have to revisit later in the week or next month or something like that. But multitasking is destructive to living purposefully. People who really, really succeed and find the joy in selling find a way to relax into an extremely purposeful day. Goal-oriented, focused on the high-priority activities, knowing at any given moment I'm doing what needs to be done to achieve my goal, and I'm in charge of that. Only I can decide what that is. Only I choose my goals, and only I know what I need to do to reach those goals. That's my purpose. That guides me. And sure, I get distracted. And sure, some people call. Problems come up. But I know what to return to. I know my purpose. Habit number 5, consciously improving the quality of communication. The first step in this habit is for a salesperson to take full responsibility for every word that goes into their computer and going out over email, every word that's left on a voicemail to a client, every word that goes in a letter of proposal, every word that's spoken in a conversation, during a presentation, during a conversation over the phone, a general sense, and even a conscious declaration, I take full responsibility for the quality of my communication today. Is it benevolent? Is it kind? Is it service-oriented? Is it intelligent? Is it well-prepared? Does it show that I've thought about their problems and thought about their lives? I take full responsibility for the quality of my communication and the improvement of the same, and I will continue to do so. The more conscious I am of the quality of my communication, the more responsibility I take for it, the more it improves, the more it gets better, and the more my clients seem to notice it. Boy, it was really great talking to you last week. That was one of the best conversations we've ever had. And you'll see surprising results like that. But it can only come from consciously taking full responsibility for the quality of this communication that I'm having with you. Consciously taking full responsibility for everything I say to you, for the way I listen to you, the entire communication. Habit number 6. It's a habit that I see very successful salespeople employ. Is a habit that refers to fear. It's a way of dealing with fear. Fear of communicating with other people, fear of cold calling, fear of talking to strangers, fear of asking for a lot of money, fear of the big conversation, fear of talking someone into making a decision right now. There are all kinds of subtle fears that come into a sales conversation and a sales presentation, and there's a habit for dealing with those fears that works very quickly for people in sales who succeed and enjoy their work. And that habit is this: challenging fear by strengthening goals. In other words, when my goal is clear to me, when I really know what I want, for example, let's say across the street, the house is burning down. There's an infant in that house, in the burning building. I am so clear that I want to get in there and get that baby out of the house that I don't have any fear at this moment. I'm running in, I'm grabbing the child, I'm running out, I'll deal with the fear later. If I have fear, it might be in my body somewhere, but it's probably energizing me. It's probably a good thing. It's probably giving me adrenaline. And that's the same thing that happens in sales. If I find myself afraid or anxious, what that is a signal that I'm unprepared. I need to prepare better. I need to be more confident. I need to feel stronger about why I'm there and what I want and how I can help. So I need to clean that up and clear that up so that that's so clear to me. My goal is so clear to me that the fear all of a sudden takes a back seat. It doesn't matter anymore. I'm now focused on what I want. Habit number 7, combining personal and professional goals. When I do my one-on-one consulting with salespeople who are underachieving, non-producing, non-performing, nobody hurts more than they do. Nobody feels worse about it than they do. On some level, they understand that they could be doing really well. They really get that deep down, but they think they don't know how. They think they need a new system, or they need more mentoring, or they need some kind of training. But that's not really what's missing. What I find that's missing is a clear desire to succeed, a really clear desire to go out and hit a certain number and make a certain commission. That's gone. That's not really there. So what takes its place? I mean, we are goal-achieving entities. Human beings achieve goals all day long, whether they want to admit it or not. And when people are not achieving the goal professionally that they would like to, it's usually because they have other priorities that take precedent. And when you look at salespeople who are underperforming, you find that their true hierarchy of priorities usually includes not getting fired. That's usually number one. Not disappointing the spouse too much with the monthly figures. That's number two. And it's a long list of things that are generally in reaction to other people and to imaginary worries about what other people think of them. And then way down there, maybe number 37, is the priority of hitting my number this month, achieving my goal, making commission. And so my job, when I'm a consultant, when I'm brought in to increase the team's numbers, is to increase individual numbers, because that's how the team numbers go up. I figured that out a long time ago on my own. And my first job is to get people to combine their personal goals with their professional goals, because they usually have them as two completely different things. They have a long list of personal concerns, fears, anxieties, concerns, desperate needs and wants. And then they have over here in this other category the professional goal, the monthly target, the yearly target that maybe my sales manager expects me to hit and that I have agreed that, yeah, I could hit that probably. And so I want to move that target right into the heart and soul of personal goals. And the way we do that is I ask the salesperson, forgetting this job, forgetting sales, forgetting the company, what do you really want in life? What is it that you're really hoping will happen in your life? And we talk about that. And usually someone comes up with this or that, or I'd like to have a little bit of security, or I'd like to feel better about my wife and kids, or I'd like to, okay, great, let's list these things. And one of the things that people don't see very easily is that there's a very strong connection between hitting a sales goal, making a very healthy commission, and having these personal goals come true. They don't see that connection until you talk about it. Once you talk about it, once you get it very conscious and clear, all of a sudden the professional goal takes on a different context. All of a sudden, it is life. It means something big in life. It's not just, well, it's greedy, it's shallow, I want to make a certain amount of money, I want to lead the team. No, this is the stuff that I really want to have happen in my life. So I'm preparing for this presentation. It's big to me. And that's when we have transformation in performance, when we get that kind of harmony, integration between professional goals and personal goals. Habit number 8, full mental focus. Full mental focus. I mentioned a couple of times earlier my disdain for multitasking. People tell me they're multitasking, and they're really getting so much more done since they've learned to multitask, and the truth is they're not. They're getting less done. If they were to calm down and slow down and do what was truly important today, this multitasking nonsense would not get into their lives like a virus and give them the impression that their lives were out of control. Full mental focus means always being aware of the top priority to complete satisfactorily for today. And how do I choose that priority? What advances me toward my goal in the most dramatic and effective way today? Again, full mental focus means actually having an appreciation for full mental focus. If I start my day and say, if I brought full mental focus to everything I did today, how would things be different? If I'm really honest with that question, I start to realize a lot of things would be different. There are a lot of things I'd choose not even to do. Let me give you an example of this. I had a client, and let's say her name is Mary, and she wanted some coaching on full mental focus. She believed that she was multitasking a lot and that she was always being given too much to do, and she couldn't hit her sales figures because there was just so much to do, so many forms to fill out, so many reports to turn in, so many meetings to go to, so many people to interact with, that how can a person succeed when they're multitasking all day and doing so many things? And so I was invited to come in to watch her life for a day and then give her consulting on how to bring more full mental focus into her day. And here's what occurred. I'll just give you a quick snippet of it. Although this happened throughout the whole day, I'll give you a quick picture. I'm sitting in Mary's office, and Mary's at her computer. She's typing an email to someone. She's looking at an email that she received from someone, and she's worried about it, and she wants to give the right answer, and so she's talking out loud to me. I told her to describe to me everything she was going to do. And she says, oh my gosh, I don't know. I don't know if this says what I want it to say. And then the phone rings. And she glances over her shoulder at the phone, and she glances back at the email, glances over her shoulder at the phone, and then hits send. Okay, it's got to be good enough. And she hits send, and now that email is gone, and she grabs the phone. As she grabs the phone, two people walk into her office simultaneously. So she's got the phone on her shoulder talking to someone, and she's motioning to those people to sit down, and then she says, excuse me, to the person on the phone, and she tells the people, please sit down, I'll be right with you, thank you for coming by. And then she tells the person on the phone, you know, I'm having a hard day, I just sent this email, I don't even know what I said, I probably shouldn't have said it, what do you have in mind right now? And then I hear her talking to the person on the phone for a long time and saying, look, really, I've got some people in the office here, I have a meeting that should have started 10 minutes ago. Can I call you back? I promise I'll call you back just as soon as I get out of my meeting. Thank you very much. And she hangs up the phone, and she turns around to talk to the people who had dropped by her office, and she sees that they've left. And so she asks me, why did they leave? And I say, well, they told me to tell you that they're going to come back when you have more time to talk to them, when you're less busy, so that you can really focus on the subject they want to talk about. So now Mary rolls her eyes and says, oh my gosh, what a day. Now I'm just giving you a small slice of her day. Now let's look forward to what happens tomorrow. The email that she sent was unusually harsh. She didn't mean it to be, but she didn't have time to warm it up, tone it up, and it was very harsh. The person who got her email took offense and thought, why is Mary sending me an email like that? I did not deserve it. I do not like it. I'm not going to deal with her by email anymore. And that person has called Mary to schedule an appointment. They want to meet with Mary. Now, the person on the phone, as the day goes by, I don't bring it up again, but Mary forgets to call them back. The two people who came into the meeting are going to have to come back. Now, let's look at multitasking here. The two people who came in once are going to come back again tomorrow. The person on the phone who called and didn't get a call back has now decided, I'm not going to deal with Mary over the phone, I'm going to go see her about this. The person on the email who did not get a full mental focus email, but got a multitasked email, is now saying, I need to schedule an appointment with Mary, this is not right. I don't care for this email, I'm upset, I'm going to show it to some people and see if they agree with me. So of course Mary's life is out of control. And where does it come from? An exaggerated affection for multitasking, and no value given in the mind of Mary for full mental focus. I'm going to slow down to the speed of life. I'm going to focus on every conversation and bring it to completion so it doesn't show up again tomorrow. Habit number 9. Selling by not selling. And what I mean by that is that people who really succeed in sales transform the entire activity away from the concept of selling, even though they have high respect for that, into the day-to-day concept of building relationships. When they think in terms of the relationship with the client, how can I make it better? How can I serve them a little bit? How can I contribute to their lives today? How can I show them a demonstration of my commitment to them? How can I make them happier? How can I make it easier for them to access this information? Continual expansion of the relationship. When they're thinking in relationship terms, their sales go up. Habit number 10, obsessively increasing product knowledge. Product knowledge seems like it would be the most boring, the most uncreative, the most unspiritual, unenergetic component of sales skills. But the opposite is true. Anytime you know a lot about something, anytime you thoroughly understand, appreciate, and know every nuance of anything, a car you're selling, a policy you're selling, a CD you're selling, anything, you have more passion for the subject, you have more excitement about it, and you have more contagious enthusiasm when you talk about it, even if you're not demonstrating your product knowledge. The fastest way that salespeople increase their enthusiasm and energy for sales is to learn more and more about the benefits of their product. To study that, to learn about it, to obsess about it, to really get to be the world expert in this product, and their enthusiasm goes up. It's not like they have to come across as some kind of high IQ nerd, some kind of whiz kid. That's really not it. They have the quiet, calm enthusiasm about the subject that the client picks up on. Boy, you really love this, don't you? Boy, I can just tell you're really into this. You really think this is the answer for me, don't you? I can tell you do. And that kind of thing's contagious. Now I'd like to read to you a few sections from a brand new book I've just finished writing called The Joy of Selling. And I'm going to read you some sections from it. Before I read this section called Guide Them Toward the Dream, I'd like you to know where all these come from. Everything in this book comes from the successful salespeople I've had the privilege and opportunity to consult with and work with, and most especially from those who were not successful for a long time and figured out ways to think that led them to success. That's what interests me the most. Guide Them Toward the Dream. Lunita was a salesperson who realized she sold more once she learned to analyze dreams. Lunita would ask, "What do you want? What is your dream? What would you love to see happen in your business?" Then, finding out what the client's answers were to these questions, Lunita promised to play her small part in bringing that dream into reality. "I promise I will help you," she would say. "I will help you get what you intend to have. I will focus all of my actions and all of my thinking on your goals. My office machines I'm selling you will play an important part in that. They'll make things more effective and more efficient for you around the office as you move toward your future. Your goals will be reached a little bit faster because of that promise." Lunita led her team in sales. Quit trying to succeed. The other day in a seminar I was giving, I placed a book on the table in front of me, and then I asked a salesperson named Dave to come up to the front of the room and try to pick that book up off the table. I said, "Dave, here's what I want you to do. Try to pick that book up off the table." Well, Dave came up, and he picked the book up quite easily, handed it to me, looked at me like I was crazy. And then I said, "No, Dave, that's not what I asked you to do." I then asked Julie to come up front. "Now, thank you, please, Julie. Please, you try to pick that book up." Julie picked the book up. "Sorry, Julie. Not what I requested." Dave and Julie both looked at me with expressions that said, "What do you mean?" I said to them and to the rest of the room and the salespeople in the room, "I didn't ask you to pick the book up," I said. "Yes, you did," they said. "No, I asked you to try to pick the book up." What I was illustrating to the group was that there is a huge difference between trying to do something and doing it. It's a huge difference, like day and night. If I tell myself that I'm going to try to make some sales calls on the phone this morning before going to lunch, my brain hears it as a completely different communication than if I say, "I am going to make 4 calls before lunch." In one case, the trying case, I'm not using my mind to command my brain at all. I'm simply stating a wish or a hoped-for effort in some direction. In the other case, the one in which I specifically say 4 calls I will make before lunch, I'm using my mind to issue my brain a clear and crystal command, a simple but strong instruction, a quiet but irrevocable order. Let's look again at what Dave and Julie did. I said, "Try to pick up the book." But inside their minds, they quickly changed the order. They translated it into something more actionable. Their mind said to their brain, "Pick the book up." In order to not let me down or embarrass themselves in front of the room, they converted my wishy-washy try into "pick it up," without really totally being conscious of what they were doing. It's so much better when we can do this consciously. Just as it helps me to remember that try is a weak word that doesn't issue a command at all. In fact, the word try will suggest to my brain that this action might not get done. When I hear myself saying, I'll try to finish that proposal by tomorrow, it helps to stop and take a deep breath and ask myself whether I'm really committed to finishing that proposal by tomorrow. If I am, I'll change my wording, I'll change my brain coding to will do it by tomorrow. My mind encodes my brain. What I often forget is that my brain is simply an impersonal body part designed to serve me, just like my hand is, just like my foot is, just like my nose is. They're all designed to serve me. The brain all the more. The brain is designed to be the ultimate instrument of service to the mind. And yet, when I underperform and slip in spirit, it's because that very gear has been stripped of the command function. I am not crystal in my communication from my mind to my brain. I'm in my weakest mode, my trying mode. If Nike had not overdone it in its advertising, the most powerful phrase to restore this command function in my biocomputer would be, just do it. When I say, call four people, it's the same as telling my hand, pick up that book. It's unlikely that I would command, try to see if you can pick up that book. The doorbell rings. When I get up to answer the door, it would never be in response to the mind message, try to see if you can answer the door. That would never happen. The mind message instead is, answer the door. As you drive around today, think this over. Your mind tells your brain what to do. It can tell it cleanly and crisply, or it can offer up vague and weak suggestions. And the brain, because the brain is impersonal and only lives to serve, will carry the clearest commands out. If your mind tells your brain to do something, your brain immediately uses whatever body parts are necessary to get the job done. If you're driving your car and your mind says, turn left up here, your brain responds by immediately activating the hands and arms, and a left turn is almost automatically made. That happens with anything you really, clearly want to do. It can also happen with sales activities, too. But if you communicate with your brain in trying terms, your results will be terrible. Or if you say, see if you can get some calls in this morning, that message, too, is loaded with heavy double meaning and pessimism. It's not a clear command at all. The brain knows that it can try without actually accomplishing anything. In fact, for people who are struggling with professional success in sales, that's usually what's happening all day long. I'm going to ask you to make 10 sales calls every morning this week, my sales manager once told me when I was selling in other speakers' seminars. Why 10? I would ask myself. Why not just leave me alone and let me make as many as I can? Finally, I got the courage to ask him out loud. Why 10? I said to him. Why don't you just trust me to try and do as many as I can? He said, when we leave it to chance, it drops out of existence. When we track it, it finds reality. Sales go up. It's not babysitting, it's managing. See it any way you want, but I recommend seeing it as a contribution to your success. I resented him, but today I can see that he had the basic process right. Mind commands brain, brain commands body, body creates circumstance. If I'm thirsty for that glass of orange juice, I never say, try to get some orange juice from the refrigerator. Just try. Make the effort. Make a decent show of it. Resemble someone who is trying to do it. Instead, I say, get the orange juice. And because I do that, I always drink orange juice when I want to. But in the important, unresolved problem areas of my life, I'm still trying. Stay in the conversation. Reports over the years claim that the average salesperson spends just 1.5 hours a day selling. 1.5 hours. Those reports shock a lot of people who think they're spending the whole day selling. The only real reason salespeople would let their selling time drop to that low a level would be ignorance. They're simply ignorant of when they're selling and when they're not. They've convinced themselves that everything they do all day is necessary, so therefore, there is no way to add selling to the day without adding hours. But that's not true. Once you heighten your awareness of when you're selling and when you're not, you can find all kinds of ways to increase your selling time here and there. Every time you do, your income will increase too. It all starts out with your clear awareness of when you're in a conversation. At any given moment in your day, you are either in a sales conversation or you are not. Your minutes each day can be accurately and precisely measured as either in or out of a conversation for a selling opportunity. If you carried around a little beeper that went off at odd times, and you had to jot down the words in or out every time it went off, based on whether at that very minute you were in a sales conversation, you'd find out why you are succeeding or failing at sales. People who fail in sales fail for one reason only. They stay outside of the conversation. They subconsciously don't want to be inside the conversation, even though the conversation is where sales always occur. Sales cannot happen outside of that conversation. No sale has ever occurred outside of a conversation. You can learn to respect the power of the conversation. Learn to be drawn to it. You can learn to have the conversation be all you move toward all day. Soon you might even find yourself feeling awkward whenever you're not in one. Let yourself feel that. It will lead to great things. There is no middle area that you can be in. You're either in a conversation or you are not. If you are not, you will not sell. No sale can occur outside of a conversation. Yet, most salespeople have no awareness of all the time they spend outside of sales conversations. If they knew, they'd be shocked. The best way to produce this awareness, and therefore heighten your sales performance, is to track yourself. Spend 2 experimental days logging each minute of your business day. Open up a little notebook. Whenever you go into a sales conversation, log in. When you stop the conversation, log out. Write down the time of day to the minute. At the end of the day, add up your minutes. You might be surprised at first. Unless you're currently leading the nation in sales, you might be surprised at how little time you spend inside the conversation that leads to sales. Think of it like the old factory time clocks. You punch in when you're working, and you punch out when you stop. Because if you really track this, the news is going to get good. Soon your heightened awareness will take you up into your spirit. You'll feel different when you're logged in. The more logged in you are, the more effective your day will feel. There will even be times when you feel like you've lived 3 days in a day. Put your hand in the hand. Beware of the electronic virtual universe. It can be truly unreal. It can fool you and make you feel like you're in control. It can make you think you are connecting when you're not. Always remember to be real, not just virtual. You can't count on a virtual relationship for sales to happen. Your relationship has to be warm and personal. Too many people become addicted to email and fax and voicemail. It seems easier. It seems like you're in more control. You don't have all those uncertain human emotions rising up like they do whenever someone's talking back to you or asking you questions. You don't have an untrustworthy human to talk to. Going electronic feels like communication. It feels like progress, but beware. Because in the end, when everything else is equal, people buy from the relationship they trust the most. The person they have been with in person. In person, you can hear all the subtleties in the human voice. In email, you can't. In person, you can see into a person's eyes. You can see the eyes twinkle. You can see them widen with worry. You can see them glaze over if you're talking too much. If you're in someone's office, you can learn so much about the person by the pictures on the wall, by the funny objects on the desk, by everything. There are tones everywhere. I was in a client's office recently, a prospective client, and while I was there, he took a call about his niece who was having problems. When he got off the phone, he looked very depressed, so I asked him if he was okay. "Oh, yeah, well, it's my niece," he said. "She's such a great person, so smart, but she's involved with drinking again." "Well, I know what that's like," I said. "I had that problem myself for many years. My prospects seemed to pick up." He said, "That's right. I remember reading about your problem in one of your books. I want to give her that book. She loves to read, and it would be a great way to reach out to her." I looked at him and I said, "Look, I'll send you the book tomorrow. And if she wishes, she can call me after she reads it. All I have to share is my own story, but sometimes that's all someone needs to be inspired to get some help. She needs to get help. She has a great opportunity in all of this." He looked at me like I was nuts. "Opportunity?" "Yes, the opportunity to grow her spirit and help other people. Addiction is bad, but if you recover from it in some ironic way, it's good. It gives you an experience of using the spirit that a lot of people never get." My prospect was totally lit up by now. I won't share the entire story of how things turned out with his niece, but they turned out very well. And that's not even the point. The point is that if I had not been there in person, if I'd been conducting all my communications by email and fax, I wouldn't have tuned in to the personal side of my prospect's life. He and I never would have had a chance to grow closer or to be humans together. Sometimes I catch myself hiding behind being professional. I want all my sales relationships to be above board and controlled. I want to only talk about business. But that's not the route to greatness in sales. I have to keep reminding myself of that. Greatness comes from a network of relationships built on giving and sharing. Great salespeople make friends. They're not afraid to live life in a friendly and interactive way. There's no chilly or stingy hiding out. There's no playing life close to the vest. Trust is everything. A trusted friendship is stronger than discounted pricing every time. Friends buy from friends. The more distant you are, the stranger you become. If you have the basic people skills it takes to make a friend, you can succeed in sales. Why is this not obvious and easy? Because of fear. We have secret fears that we don't even know about. We have fears that date back to childhood that cause us to age regress whenever we're in a potential sales situation. We need to rise above that, and we can. We can outgrow those fears quite easily. That's one of the many joys of selling. To reach huge success, we need to risk ourselves every day. We need to offer ourselves up in person to other people. And if they're too cold or professional to create a friendship with us, well, that's not our problem. That's their problem, because they have not outgrown their own fears. But with continued acts of kindness and friendship, we can help them take their fears away. Tuck that puppy under your arm and go. Pick a place you want to be with your customer. Then get into action in that direction. Don't consult your feelings. Don't consult your self-doubt. Self-doubt is like a puppy you tuck under your arm before running across a six-lane highway. Previously, as you were walking the side road, that puppy might have been your whole mental focus, but not right now, because you've decided to make the run. Most people, including me, most of my life, think they have to get rid of that puppy before even thinking about making the bold run. Given how this self-doubt preoccupies the mind with all its whining and squirming, they can't even imagine themselves making a bold run at something until it's gone. But their only options will always be these. Number one, attend completely to the puppy of self-doubt all day long. Or number two, tuck that puppy under your arm and go. Slow down and be complete. One of the greatest problems people in sales create for themselves is the problem of life scatter. Paradoxically, they waste time by doing too much. They place such a high priority on a speedy reaction to anything that comes up, they never settle in to the really important stuff. The important stuff is a long, slow, and relaxed conversation with a prospective buyer. A conversation that has no urgency to it at all. It's a conversation that feels as if it's happening for the pleasure that it gives both people. You yourself don't need to be anywhere else but here. In fact, you don't want to be anywhere else but here. That's not how most of us sell. Most of us sell frantically in between all the interruptions. Cell phones keep screaming at us like children with bee stings. Migraine lights flash on the phone panel on the desk. People's heads pop in our doorway like meat puppets yelling, "Got a minute? Got a minute? Got a minute? Got a minute? Got a minute?" The mind doesn't know where to turn next. It's being pushed and pulled and probed and pinched and slapped and popped around all day. Poor mind. Poor beanbag. No wonder it wants to quit. Slow down. Learn to enter your selling conversation like you would a large, warm bathtub of rainbow soapy water. And once you're in there, stay until you're relaxed and comfortable. Go nonlinear. Sometimes it's fun and profitable, after you've gotten good at hitting singles, to pick a day to hit a home run. Pick a day to go nonlinear on yourself, to make a total quantum leap, not from A to B, but from A to infinity. In other words, sometimes it's very effective to go crazy for a while and do things normal salespeople would never dream of doing. To think big and ask for a huge price and a major deal just to see the look on their faces. Normal salespeople are often very linear. They go from A to B to C to D to E to F to G. They are incremental all day, all week, all month, all year. They make continuous improvements, little by little, inching their way from being miserable to being a little better than miserable. Baby steps all in a row. You ought to try breaking out of this routine every so often. Change how you sell completely, just for a thrill. Just to see how fun and crazy you can make your sales life be. And always keep in mind that your sales life has the potential, more potential actually than just about any other profession, to be fun and crazy. That's because one of the great things about sales is that there's no right way to always do it well. You can do it many different ways. Experiments will succeed at opening you up more to more possibilities. On one sales call I went on, I took my guitar. I sang my prospective customer a song. It was the fight song from the University of Arizona called Bear Down Arizona. I knew he loved the Arizona Wildcats. We ended up joking about it in one of our first calls. My song showed him that I'm not someone who forgets those calls. One day later in my life, I gave a talk to a sales staff in which I told them to slow down and take their time. The next month, I told the same staff to speed everything up. I told them to live each day this week as if it were their last day before a long vacation and they had to close everything. You know what they said? Are you nuts? You told us last week to slow down. My point was to shake things up. The brain plays dead when it's left alone with no new thinking.